there is three predictions that were made about Srila Prabhupada's appearance in the world before he actually appeared. And one of them is by Krishna himself. And it's written in one scripture called Brahmanda Purana, where Lord Krishna speaks. He says, within 5,000 years, a personality will come, and he will be called Mantra Upasika, and he will take my holy name everywhere around the world. So this was 5,000 years or more ago that this was actually recorded as a statement by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we know that Srila Prabhupada's appearance was a divine appearance. It was orchestrated by the Lord himself. In the late 1400s, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also, speaking to Sri Narada Muni, also made a similar prediction that soon, he said the word soon, a great soul will come and take the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra everywhere. And then the most recent prophetic statement was by Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur, where he understood, and he also wrote, that a great soul will appear and he will make the whole world chant Hare Krishna. So we get a little insight about Srila Prabhupada's greatness, that he is not just a personality who somehow became very spiritual during his time and then became, what we say, greatly fortunate and empowered. No, that's also there, but he is actually ordained by the Lord to do this work. When someone asked Srila Prabhupada, why didn't you come sooner? Prabhupada said, you weren't ready for me. He came at a time when people were ready to accept that message. And because of that, Prabhupada was able to pick up so many personalities and bring them to Krishna consciousness. Bring the other chair here. Oh, okay. There is a interesting statement which I was personally present when I heard. This was about 10 to 15 years ago. Prahlad Nanda Maharaj ki jai. When I was in Mayapur Dham, when Bhakti Charum Maharaj organized a huge program within his home, which he has a beautiful apartment in Sridhar Mayapur. And he called all of Prabhupada's disciples for this meeting, and there was a great attendance of Prabhupada's disciples, at least, I don't know, anywhere from 80 to 100 Prabhupada disciples had come for this gathering, and it was all about hearing about Srila Prabhupada or talking about Srila Prabhupada. And one personality, a very senior Prabhupada disciple, he spoke and he said something really quite interesting. He said, I was massaging Srila Prabhupada. Was one of my services, not a regular service, but a service I did when it was needed. And usually Prabhupada, during those times, he would speak about something, but this time he was quite quiet, and I was feeling a little bit awkward because Prabhupada would always speak something Krishna conscious or something important, something relevant to spreading Krishna consciousness. And then all of a sudden, Prabhupada just started to speak, and he started to speak about himself. And he said, I was in the spiritual world with Krishna, and Krishna told me, go to the material world and preach. I said to Prabhupada, material world? Horrible place. Horrible place. That's the way it was described. And but Krishna said to me, no, you go, you write some books, and I'll protect you. So, and that was the end. That was quite powerful when I heard that. That Prabhupada actually understood that he was sent by Krishna to do this work. So when we understand the position of Srila Prabhupada, we know he's Nitya Siddha. Nitya Siddha means he's an eternally liberated soul who came to do this work of spreading Lord Chaitanya's mission around the world for the benefit of the entire human population. And of course, Lord Chaitanya said, you know, every town and village, my name will be chanted. We get a little insight of the greatness of Srila Prabhupada. Of course, sometimes they say, and when a person is very humble, that humility seems to kind of cover over the greatness. Usually you think of somebody great, somebody's really dynamic, powerful, and Prabhupada was like that. But his humility was just so natural and so, what we say, accommodating, that he could speak to anyone and everyone. And he would never be like in a different realm. He could play with little kids. He would take Malati's little daughter, and she had a little thing of Krishna. So he took it. She was there. She showed it. Prabhupada took it. And he put it behind his back and said, "Where's Krishna? Where's Krishna? Where's Krishna?" And little Saraswati, that's what her name was, she said, "Where's Krishna? She started to cry. "Krishna, where's Krishna? Where's Krishna?" Prabhupada said, "Here's Krishna." So Prabhupada would do that. He would even be very, you know, sweet to little children. And he could speak to the most elevated persons in the material world who are, you know, very prestigious and very, what we say, respected in that way. And he could, astound them with the way he presented Krishna conscious philosophy. Prabhupada was a genius. When you listen to Srila Prabhupada's lectures, you see how he places the philosophy in such a way that it's so unique, but it's so right to the point. He doesn't beat around the bush or kind of like just guess. He's clear, spontaneous, and the way he responds to questions or presents a problem and then answers the problem, it's like you wouldn't think that's the way the answer would come, but Prabhupada would be like that. He had a way to answer that was his own style, but it was so clear and so powerful. When Prabhupada was in London, 1973, he wanted to meet important people. He said, "Bring important people to me. I want to discuss Krishna consciousness with them." And so Shyamasundara was there with Prabhupada. And Shyamasundara, if you know Shyamasundara, he is very, what we say, innovative. He knows how to do things. And he was able to meet so many poets, authors, and people from various, what we say, religious and secular backgrounds that had positions in the material world. I can't remember all of the personalities that he met. But one time, there was a society called the Mensa Society. It's in London. And Mensa Society is considered to be a very erudite, philosophical, analytic society. And they take great analytic problems and try to discuss it and come up with answers. This is their whole, you know, program. So they came, and there was a few of them, and they came on Shyamasundara's, you know, invitation to meet Srila Prabhupada. So they were talking, and Prabhupada was explaining how Krishna is the all-powerful Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Prabhupada explained that there's nothing outside of Krishna's power. In fact, everything is his power, and everything works under his power. He is all powerful. Sometimes Prabhupada would give a little example just to bewilder us. He would say, Krishna is all powerful. He can make day into night and night into day. I'm trying to figure that one out. But in other words, there was nothing outside of Krishna's, you know, all-powerful force that he couldn't do. So this Mensa society, they're used to, you know, philosophical wrangling. He's going back and forth with ideas. So one of the leaders said, well, you know, I guess he called him Swami. Well, Swami, can Krishna lift? Can Krishna create a rock he can't lift? It's a trick question. Because if you say yes, then that limits his lifting power. And if you say no, that means his creative power is not there. So whatever way you answer, it's wrong. So don't try to trick Prabhupada. So Prabhupada said, yes, Krishna can create a rock he can't lift, and then he'll lift it. So that was the end of that discussion. Sometimes devotees would try to second-guess Srila Prabhupada, you know, try to figure out what he was doing or what he's going to say, or maybe even try to play tricks on Prabhupada. You know, this is the Americans, you know, you got to get it. If you don't know Americans, and stick around, you'll find out more about us. We're kind of like an unusual group. There was two things I was going to say. Oh yeah, Prabhupada was in his room, and he was all alone, obviously, and no one was in there. So someone wanted to see, what's Prabhupada doing when he's alone? So there was one of these big, you know, elaborate doors made out of wood with a nice keyhole. So the devotee looked through the keyhole, and he could see an eye looking back at him. Don't try to spy on your spiritual man. He's watching you. And another, when Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, there was one devotee. So Prabhupada would go to his, he had a place right near the temple in Vrindavan. And Prabhupada would go out his room, and he had a pair of nice white, like, you know, moccasins or some real soft shoes. Very nice. He would put them on, and he would walk to the temple, take them off, and then go into the temple. And then when he would turn, he'd do the same thing. When he got to his room, he'd leave it right in front of the door. So one devotee was thinking, I'm going to get those shoes. I want those shoes. They're special shoes. They're Prabhupada shoes. So he made a plan, and he found out the exact size. Went to shopping in Vrindavan and found the exact same pair. So now he was going to make the switch. So he, you know, Prabhupada, every day had that same pattern. So now he's ready. This is the time he's going to do it. And he's watching Prabhupada go into his room. And this time, instead of Prabhupada going into the room and taking his shoes off for him, he walks in the room with his shoes on. First time he ever did it. Just the time when the devotee was going to do that. And the devotee was thinking, he never does that. And then the next day, Prabhupada was giving class, and he said, don't try to play tricks on your spiritual master. Yeah, you couldn't do that. Prabhupada, you know, he could see through everything, whatever. Sometimes he would look at you, and you would think, oh my God, what is he saying? Prabhupada could see you for who you were. And he could also, he wouldn't judge you, but he could understand everything about you, practically everything about you, just by looking at you. And he did that with me, and I got nervous. So yeah, Prabhupada had that power, and he had that foresight. So when we listen to Prabhupada's lectures, either he talks about the present, or he talks about the past, or he talks about the future, you can understand what he's saying has value and has truth. It's not something that he is theoretically trying to assume. Prabhupada was Trikala Gyan. He knew past, present, and future. There's one, I mean, there's a few interesting stories in the life of Srila Prabhupada that are really worth. I told one this morning, but this one is a really interesting story. Shruti Kirti Prabhu, we know for many years, he was Prabhupada's, you know, personal servant. And he would do other works, such as arranging for Prabhupada's cooking, everything like that. So one time Prabhupada was in Mexico City, Mexico, and he had to take a short flight to Caracas, Venezuela. So he was leaving the place, and one lady, she had some prasadam for Prabhupada, and she wrapped it in some aluminum foil and gave it to Prabhupada. Prabhupada immediately gave it to Shruti Kirti and says, "We will take it later." So when they got on the plane, and Prabhupada always liked to sit near the window. He liked the window seat. And one thing Prabhupada would always do, not always, but a lot of times, is that just before landing, usually about 20 minutes before landing, the pilot gets on and says, "Okay, we're making our descent now, everyone into their seats with your seatbelts." As soon as that would come on, Prabhupada would get up and go to the restroom. One time he was doing that, Shruti Kirti was telling me, and the stewardess said, "Excuse me, sir, you have to sit down." And Prabhupada just kept walking. She wasn't even there. So Prabhupada, you know, he said, "I always did what I wanted to do." I always did what I wanted to do. So while they were on the plane, Prabhupada's on the window, Shruti Kirti Prabhu's in the middle, and Paramahansa Swami's traveling, so there's three of them, and he's at the aisle seat. So Prabhupada said, "Prasad." And so Shruti Kirti takes out the little, you know, aluminum foil, and he opens it up, and he puts it on Prabhupada's little desk there in front, little table. So Prabhupada starts taking a little bit, and then he takes it and passes it over to Shruti Kirti. And Shruti Kirti takes some of it and gives it to Paramahansa. So they're just about to honor it. And they're actually honoring it. And then the stewardess, she comes over and says, "Oh, that looks nice." And she went and put it right in her mouth, right from Shruti Kirti's plate. And he's thinking, "What is this?" The stewardess grabs the food and she's eating it. And Prabhupada's just looking. He's not even fazed. And he turns to Shruti Kirti, "Ask her if she can get us some hot milk." So he did. And she came. She said, "Oh, yes, I'll go to a business class and I'll be back." And she came with a nice glass of hot. Prabhupada was very pleased. So that's pretty much the end of the story, I thought. Then one day I was reminding Shruti Kirti Prabhu of that story. He said, "You know, Maharaj, I was giving a class just recently, talking about Prabhupada, and I had just finished after 3 hours of speaking about Prabhupada. And I was tired. I was thinking, I want to, you know, take some rest. So I was getting off my seat, and two brahmacharis walk up to me and said, 'Can we speak to you?'" And this is the way he described it. He said, "Oh, I'm so tired." "No, this is important." "Okay." So they said, "We were doing books in Mexico, and we were going door to door in the outer regions, more like in the village areas. So he came to one house and we knocked on the door and we opened it, and it was this lady, and she was, 'Oh, Hare Krishna, come on in.'" And her whole house was decorated. She had pictures and various types of paraphernalia that we use, and was the same stewardess. She got Prabhupada's remnants, and just by doing that, she had no other contact with Krishna consciousness. Maha, maha. That's powerful. The Shastras say, there's three things that are extremely rare and extremely powerful substances. The water that washes the feet of the great devotees, the pure devotees, the dust from their lotus feet, and their prasadam. These three things. It's the Nectar of Devotion says that one should make an effort to get it. And sometimes the devotees would, when Prabhupada would finish his plate, they would take the plate and run in the other room and just without distributing it to the other devotees, which they were supposed to do, they would say, it's maha maha. So it's very powerful spiritual substances. So don't miss the opportunity. In fact, seek out the opportunity to get the maha mana, maha mana, maha maha, because it is very spiritually powerful. It's like a funny story. Prabhupada was in Hawaii, and in Prabhupada's room, the toilet didn't work. So he calls the devotees. He said, the toilet's not working. Get it fixed. And so they said, okay. So they went out, and they came back after some time. I think it was another day later. And then Prabhupada asked him, is the toilet working? And they said, yes, Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, did you try it? It's working, Prabhupada. No, did you try it? And they didn't know what to say. So Prabhupada said, come on. So he went into the kitchen, and he made some chapati dough, and he rolled it into balls, and he said, here, place this in the toilet, and then flush it. And they were thinking, what is it? Okay. So they did it, and they came back. It works, Prabhupada. Now you try to figure that one out. I can't. It's hard to understand that particular, mood of Prabhupada. Well, that was Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada always knew how to respond to a situation. There was one lady who joined the movement, and she hated men. Men. Don't even give me that word. And then she somehow or other, she came into Krishna consciousness. And then after some time, I don't know how long later, she said to Prabhupada, I can't worship that man, Krishna. And Prabhupada said, that's okay, Radharani's higher. Okay. She was pretty much pacified by that. So sometimes we have, people come to our society that we're not sure how to really engage them in activities or place them properly within the ashram. So one gay man came, and so, what do you do with a gay person? He wants to join the ashram. Hare Krishna. So they wrote to Prabhupada, we have this man, he's gay. So if we put him in the brahmachari ashram, it's not so good, and we can't put him in the ladies' ashram because he's not one of them. So what do we do? So Prabhupada said, well, choose one of the two, but make sure he doesn't change. Choose one of the two, but make sure he doesn't change. So I don't know what happened after that, but anyway. And that was told us by Anuttama Prabhu. He told that story. So Prabhupada always knew how to deal with situations. And Prabhupada's devotion was so powerful. And it was so... Just seeing Prabhupada, just being anywhere around him, the whole atmosphere would be spiritualized just by his presence, even if he wasn't speaking. The devotees had so much attraction. They would live simply to get an instruction from Prabhupada. If Prabhupada gives me an instruction, anything, whatever it is, then I'm happy and my life is successful. Of course, sometimes devotees felt that the instructions were a little too hard to carry out. Like Prabhupada never liked us to give up one particular service in order to do another one. When Prabhupada would sometimes say, well, we have to do this service, and then they would say to Prabhupada, well, okay, but which area should we, slow down or cut out? Prabhupada, no cutting out, no slow. You add. You just add, that's all. He knew that, especially in the American mentality, is that, There's two aspects to it. One of them is keep them busy or else they're in trouble. Or else they'll cause trouble somehow. And so he always kept us busy. He did that with all his disciples. He understood that, you know, we're still affected by the modes of passion and ignorance. So if we stay engaged always in devotional service, we would have a chance to, you know, rise above these lower modes. So Prabhupada wanted us to be fully engaged in devotional service. And of course, that is our understanding of how to make advancement in devotional service. But as a principle, it was a way to keep us, you know, in the right direction, keep the devotees engaged 24/7. And Prabhupada said, and he said, you guys are Americans, you got to do something important. He said, your country's important, and you have to do something big. So do something big for Krishna. That was Prabhupada. So he always encouraged us to do something more, something big. He sent three couples to London he gave them, I think it was $150, or maybe a little bit more, I'm not sure how much it was. And before you, in those days, when you have to go into London, you had to show that you had some financial support, otherwise you couldn't get in. And so the devotees came in at one couple at a time. So one couple, they came in with their money, they showed that this is, we have some money and we can take care of ourselves. And then once they got in, they took the money and they wired it to the other couple. And then they got in and they gave it to the third couple. And that's how the three couples got in. And eventually that's what opened up the entire London Yatra. It was really amazing how much sacrifice they made for Srila Prabhupada. They were living in basements without any, you know, regular income or even any food. They were just making friends and getting whatever they needed to somehow live. So that was what it was like in the early days of spreading Krishna consciousness. Sometimes Prabhupada would just give you a service and he would say, open up a temple or go here or, you know, distribute some books. And Prabhupada pushed us into learning how to really surrender like that. He said, I am pushing you. And he told the leaders that were leading the devotees, you have to push the other devotees. But he says, push, but don't break. So he said that the art of pushing is knowing how you can push someone, but not causing them to, you know, go away because of too much pushing. But Prabhupada did everything. There's a specific book that's just came out. It's called I Will Build You a Temple by Giriraj Swami. He worked on that book for 20 years or more, gathering information and very carefully composing this book. It's about 600 pages or more. And it's about the entire effort that the devotees made in order to build the Radharasa Bihari Temple in Bombay. What a fight that was. And Prabhupada once said, somebody should write a book about this. But when you read that book, you see how Prabhupada made the difference for the whole thing. It was only because of him intervening in the right time and at the same time understanding how to deal with people who were trying to cheat. And it wasn't just one person, it was practically the entire municipality of Bombay that were causing devotees hardships, either trying to discourage them or just get as much money as they could from the devotees. Because they knew Prabhupada had money coming in from Western countries. But Prabhupada somehow or other was able to fight his way through that. And to this day, a grand temple is. When you read that, you just see how intelligent Prabhupada could deal with, even in material ways. He wasn't like, you know, just like very adept spiritually. He knew how the material energy was working, and he knew how to deal in situations. Just like when we first started the Organizer Society, we wanted to centralize all the temples under one umbrella. Prabhupada said, no, don't do that. Because if there's ever a lawsuit or a problem, then we lose our whole society. Prabhupada could foresee that. And we, of course, we know we had two lawsuits where they tried to destroy our society. But because Prabhupada made each temple independent entities, they had to attack each temple separately. They couldn't attack us as a society. And because of that, you know, we have a society in the Western world, in America now still. That was Prabhupada's vision for the future. He could see legally, organizationally, so many things, how this movement should go on. He didn't just simply give us philosophical or spiritual knowledge. He was giving us practical day-to-day things on how to deal in this material world with people, with organizations, with situations. That was Prabhupada. He was everything. He was everything. And, of course, he wanted to delegate a lot of that to his leaders, but a lot of times they weren't up to the standard, so Prabhupada would have to take over and then somehow deal with the situation. Giriraj Swami talks about one situation where, you know, Prabhupada would stay up, and we heard from Kadambakana Maharaj how Prabhupada would spend, you know, so much time doing his Bhaktivedanta translations late in the evening. And so one time, you know, Prabhupada would be there, he would do, but sometimes Prabhupada would be thinking about how to spread Krishna consciousness. So one time he rang his bell. He'd have a bell, and usually his servant would sleep outside the door, because if Prabhupada needed anything, the ringing of the bell would wake up the servant and he would come in immediately. So this time it was Giriraj. And Giriraj came in and he's still, you know, waking up. He pays his obeisances to Prabhupada. And he sits and he's waiting for Prabhupada to speak. And Prabhupada says, "How will this movement go on when I'm gone? How will this movement go on when I'm gone?" And Giriraj said, "Well, you know, we'll be strict. We'll have all the devotees go to Mangal Arati and chant their 16 rounds, and we'll, you know, go out on book distribution." And Prabhupada just listened. He said, "This movement will go on by organization and intelligence." That's what he said. That was the answer. How to intelligently organize our movement in such a way that we get the maximum benefit from the devotees who have such great abilities, qualities, and desires to serve. But Prabhupada was thinking, you know, we have to learn how to organize things. Because without proper organization, of course, my experience in here, in Ljubljana, in Slovenia, people are very organized. Pretty good, yay. Very, very organized. I mean, there could be a few other things that happen, you know, I mean, it could get a little better, but... Just like sometimes, you know, where's the lighter for the, you know, for the RT? Okay. Oh, it's not here, okay. That's a little thing. But yeah, so Prabhupada said organization and intelligence. An example is given, just to illustrate this point, is that someone comes to you, I'll use myself as an example, someone comes to me and says, "Maharaj, can you give me a glass of milk?" And I say, "You just walk down the road and you'll see the barn. And inside the barn is the cow, and you go in there, you get your bucket, and you milk the cow, and you'll have your milk." Terrible organization. But if you come and you ask, and I am all ready, and I have it all ready for you, and I just heat it up, and I say, here's your glass of milk. That's organization and intelligence. In other words, the Brahmins, they have the intelligence. The Kshatriyas, or the leaders, are supposed to be adept at organizing everything in such a way that we get the maximum amount of benefit from our efforts in Krishna consciousness. When Prabhupada was asked, when Prabhupada said to us, and this wasn't a question, Prabhupada said to us, we could take over the world in 18 days, but you're not ready. He said, you're not ready. In other words, if we were fully surrendered and were fully able to understand how to engage according to Srila Prabhupada's direction, that's a lot of power. This movement is very, very, very powerful. Extremely powerful. Why? It's ordained by God Himself. He's empowering this movement to spread Krishna consciousness around the world. He's waiting for each and every one of us to take that mercy and that empowerment and develop it in our own practice of Krishna consciousness and spread it around the world. This movement can spread fast, as we were hearing from Prahlad Nanda Maharaj when he was talking about how he was distributing books. He was out there and he would just pray to Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada, can you send me somebody to... And as soon as he prayed like that, somebody was there and the book was out. That's Krishna. Sincere prayers make a big difference. But if we... can, when we say, amalgamate that mood in everything we do in Krishna consciousness, the most amazing things would happen. I mean, you hear how many books we've distributed as a society to this day. As close to 600 million books. And that's only what's recorded. There's a lot of books that were never really recorded that went out. So that's a lot. That's a lot. In other words, and Prabhupada really, really wanted his books distributed. He saw that this is the way to spread Krishna consciousness in a very, very direct and powerful way. I think it was 1970. I think we didn't have much, I'm not sure what was available in terms of books at that time. I think Krishna book came out in 1970, and before that we had Back to Godhead magazine, and devotees were selling incense, and Back to Godhead magazines on the street. And two devotees, they were driving a car, it was in America, they pulled into a gas station, and they got gas. And so the man filled up their car and the tank of gas, and they looked, they had no money. And that's the way it was then. You get your gas first and then you pay. But they didn't have any money. There was no credit cards. So one of the devotees, his name was Prem Ardhava. The other devotee, I can't remember his name. He's a very, very powerful book distributor. Bhudimanta. Yeah, Bhudimanta. So they had a Krishna book there. And it just recently came out. So they took the Krishna book and offered it to the gas attendant and said, can you take this as an exchange for the gas? And then they started speaking a little bit about the book, and the man said, yeah. And he took it. And that little story got back to Prabhupada eventually. And then, of course, we started to understand we could distribute books in public on the street. And that sort of sparked the whole idea of book distribution. And later, it started to build and build. And I think it was in 1973 when we really started to distribute books in a very, let me say, voluminous way. And when Prabhupada was hearing that, he would say, oh, okay, next year you double it. And so the devotees did. They not only doubled it, but they went beyond the double. So Prabhupada got the results for 1974. He said, all right, next year, you double it. So that's how you can hear some of the stories and how the devotees would just, go out in the morning and come back like about 12 o'clock at night, eat something and then go to sleep and then get up, chant their rounds and run out the door again for a full day of book distribution. And every year, up until the time of Srila Prabhupada's departure, devotees were doubling it and doubling it, and it's just more and more books were going out. Just the other day, they asked me to speak on book distribution. I was telling some stories, but Srila Prabhupada, he was one of the first book distributors ever. When he came with his Srimad Bhagavatams, he had the three volumes of the books that he had composed in India. The three volumes of the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And he came with 200 sets to America. And he was thinking what to do. And he thought, oh, bookstores. So Prabhupada was going around with his books to different bookstores and trying to get the booksellers to take his books, and hardly anybody would take it. But Prabhupada kept trying. Then he went to one place, which was it was selling clothing and books also. So he came in, the man said, well, you know, these spiritual books, they don't sell. But Prabhupada said, that's okay. You just take it, and if you sell, then you can give me something after the sale. Consignment. So the man said, all right. So he took the book. And Prabhupada came back the next day. And he said, did the book sell? He said, I told you these books don't sell. And Prabhupada left. And then Prabhupada came back the next day. And the man was a little bit annoyed that Prabhupada was coming back every day. So he said, I told you these books don't sell. But there was a little table inside where people could sit. So Prabhupada sat down. And he said to the man, can you give me a glass of water? And the man said, well, you just go over there. There's a tap over there. You can get some water. But the man's wife was there. He said, no, get him a glass of water. He wants a glass of water. So, it's good to have a good wife. So the man got up, got the glass of water, gave it to Prabhupada. Prabhupada drank half the glass and left. The next day the book sold. Because he did some service for a great soul. So that was Prabhupada. One little humorous story. You know, Prabhupada was not always so accustomed to American culture, and he did things the way he was used to in India. So they have these little supermarkets, small little markets that you could go into. So Prabhupada went shopping. This is when he first came to America, and he had these baskets you wheel around. And you put your items in the basket, you pick it off the shelf, and then you come to the cashier. So Prabhupada came up and he, put all the items in, and the lady tabulated it on the cash register, and she said, that'll be $11.55. Prabhupada said, I'll give you $5. She said, excuse me, sir, but it's $11.55. Prabhupada said, it's not worth it. I'll give you $5. And Prabhupada wasn't going to change. So she kind of like, I guess she was charmed by his presence. So she took Prabhupada's $5 and put the rest of the money for the bill in out of her own pocket. And later on, the devotees happened to meet her, and she told the whole story. Oh, she paid the rest. She said, oh, he was such a nice man. I couldn't say no. That was Srila Prabhupada. Yeah, so there are so many wonderful stories in the life of Srila Prabhupada that, really endears you to Srila Prabhupada, how he dealt with people, how he dealt with situations. He was like everything you want a person to be. He could be sweet, gentle, so soft, but he could be powerful like a thunderbolt. One senior devotee one time, Prabhupada was in Duvrindavan. Devotee's name was Janardana. And he was a preacher. So Prabhupada asked him about a particular verse in the Bhagavad Gita, and he didn't know the answer.
We were leaders of one of Radhadamodara's parties. So Janardana was in New Vrindavan, and he asked Prabhupada a question. He said, Prabhupada, the Christians say that God speaks to them. So how do we know that God is speaking to them? So Prabhupada said, do you know what verse, what does Krishna say in the Bhagavad Gita? And Janardhan said, I don't know. And Prabhupada said, you don't know what Krishna said in Bhagavad Gita? Tesham sadatam yuktanam bhajantam priti purvakam didami buddhi yogam tam yena mamupiyanti te. To those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give them the understanding by which they can come to me. And then Janardhan said, yeah, I knew that, Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, if you knew it, why didn't you say it? And Janardhan tried to defend himself. He said, no, no, Prabhupada, I actually knew, you know, I knew that. She said, if you knew it, why didn't you say that? And Prabhupada got on Janardhan, started to talk to Janardhan very strongly for the next 20 minutes. That if you knew it, why didn't you say it?
And the devotees were there, they were getting nervous because Janardhan was just sinking into the floor. Prabhupada was just going at him, and the devotees were thinking, we got to do something, so they tried to divert Prabhupada's attention away by asking him, so Prabhupada just didn't even listen to them. Poor Janardhan. Yeah, so that was... Yeah, Srila Prabhupada could, he could be like that, you know. He could be so angry that the whole room would shake, and then the next minute it's like nothing happened. It was like, you know, he wasn't even the slightest of showing any signs of that previous moment. He could change from back to forth, back and forth, which shows that this is a great soul. He's completely in control of his emotions. He can use them, he can pull them back whenever he needs. He's never controlled by his mind or senses. He knows how to use them and pull them back and not be affected on a personal level. That was Srila Prabhupada. So just to illustrate how the greatness of Prabhupada as a personality, because it's important beyond the idea of what Prabhupada has done to spread Krishna consciousness, it's also important to know the personality of Prabhupada. Because if we don't know the personality of God, Prabhupada, we really won't understand why he does what he does. I mean, we may even remain a little bewildered by that. But Prabhupada was, you know, studying the life of Srila Prabhupada means actually understanding Krishna consciousness. He was an example, and a perfect example for everything he taught and everything he wanted to teach us on all levels of Krishna consciousness. Even how to, you know, even how to, you know, eat properly. He taught us everything. He was like a perfect mother, a perfect father, a perfect teacher, everything. That was and he took the time to do that. He wasn't like, there was, of course, he was many times he wanted his senior devotees to take on the responsibilities that he was doing, because he wanted to dedicate more and more time to his translations of the Srimad Bhagavatam. But when it was necessary, Prabhupada was there to manage, to organize, to instruct, to guide the devotees. Okay, and then the one little last little story, which is a cute little story. I'll just tell this one. This happened not so long ago, maybe within the last few years. A new boy, he joined a temple in America, one of the temples there. So they immediately sent him out on book distribution, not long after he joined. And he didn't know so much about the philosophy, but, you know, they wanted to give him an experience of distributing books. So he's out there distributing books. He meets one man, and he gives the man the book. And the man's looking at the book. He's looking at it and turns it over, and he sees the picture of Prabhupada that says, A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami. And so the man looks at the boy and says, what does A.C. mean? And the boy said, always cool. So that fits too. Yeah, one time Prabhupada, he met in Chicago, he had so many problems with women's liberation movement. And one lady, she came, she was a reporter, she had a miniskirt on. And she was just, you know, firing questions. Why do you shave your head? You know, why do you wear those funny clothes? You know, she was just trying to find fault with Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was calmly answering his questions. At one point, Prabhupada said, and yes, in Krishna consciousness, it's better to have cool head and warm legs instead of cold legs and a hot head. Whoa. What could she say to that? So, you know, sometimes Prabhupada would, know how to make you like, No, yeah, he could be anything. I mean, Prabhupada would say, someone would say, I'm God. Prabhupada would say, please accept my obeisances, now sit down. And another time, and somebody would say, "I'm God." Prabhupada said, "That's very nice, but we know a better God than you. His name is Krishna. He's perfect. We don't think you're so perfect." So Prabhupada knew how to, you know, disarm people who were very challenging, and that was there was a lot of that, especially in Australia. They really when Prabhupada did one public gathering, there was all these political people that were talking about the Vietnam War, and they were challenging. And Prabhupada actually stopped the whole meeting, got out of there, and got in his car. When they were going out in the car, these same people were waiting on top of a bridge, and they poured paint on Prabhupada's car. It was really a confrontation. Prabhupada knew that if he stayed there any longer, it would turn into something violent. Well, Prabhupada had to face a lot of difficulties in his preaching. It wasn't like he was always, but he always faced it in the right way, and things always worked out for the best. That was Prabhupada. He was never defeated because he had Krishna with him always. Thank you very much.
When I joined the movement in 1968, the way we got initiated was mostly by mail. Because probably at that time I was in Buffalo and L.A. was around 3,000 miles away, around 4,000 kilometers. So we had to send our beads and a letter, a recommendation, to Prabhupada wherever he was, and then he'd chant on the beads and send us back our name. So I sent my beads to Los Angeles, but I didn't know you were supposed to send a letter of recommendation. So Prabhupada got the beads and he said, where is this boy's letter of recommendation? How can I initiate him if there's no letter? So Prabhupada had a servant at that time and he said, Swamiji at that time. He said, Swamiji, I talked to him on the telephone and he seemed like a nice boy. So Prabhupada said, so you're recommending him? So the boy said, I don't really know him, but he seemed like a nice boy. So Prabhupada said, if you think he was a nice boy, then I'll give him initiation. So right before I got the...
He's still a nice
So before I got the letter back, I was, at that time, Bhakti Godhead had, quote, cartoons in it. So there was one cartoon by Govindadasi, when it was about Prahlad and Nrsingadev. So I was reading it, and I said, oh, what a nice name, Prahlad. I wish I had that name. And just at that time, the letter came back with my beads, and in the letter, Prabhupada said, you know, please accept my blessings, you know, I'm happy to give you initiation, and your name is now Prahladananda. One who's as cheerful as Prahlad Maharaj in all kinds of critical tests. So, at that time, Prabhupada came, this is February 1969, and then Prabhupada came in March of 1969 to Buffalo. And when he came, I was always worried because when I came to the temple, I was always concerned because I didn't like to bow down. It was like a real, you know, I came from Brooklyn and you didn't bow down to anyone. So it was a real struggle bowing down. But the problem was in our temple, the altar was, as soon as you enter into the building, as I said, it was a very small building. So as soon as you entered in, there were the deities right there facing you, and you had to bow down. So I was bowing down maybe 100 times a day. Because anywhere, if you went downstairs to take, you know, for prasad or went to the kitchen, you had to bow down. You left the building, you had to bow down. Every time you had to bow down. And also you had to give the deities, every time you saw the deities, you had to give them some offering. So we had to carry around rice with them, with us, and give them a little bit of rice every time we saw them. So I was always worried, when I see Prabhupada, will I actually remember to bow down? So Prabhupada came to the airport, and when I saw him, it looked, walking down the airport, he actually appeared to me like he was floating. So I was so struck with wonder that I forgot to bow down. And then when I finally realized I should bow down, Prabhupada had already passed by. And Brahmananda came up to me and tapped me on the shoulder and he said, you have to stay here and get Prabhupada's luggage. So I was quite sensitive. I thought, well, how am I wanted to see Prabhupada, now I have to see, get his luggage. So finally I got the luggage and when I was bringing it upstairs, I was wondering, when am I going to see Prabhupada? So I kept on asking, you know, when can I see Prabhupada? And then they gave me darshan and we were sitting there. And they were just talking, it was Brahmananda, Gargamuni. And Gargamuni and Brahmananda, I was visiting New York because my parents lived in New York. So I'd go to they were at 61 Second Avenue at that time. And I'd go there with Burjan because he was the treasurer at the time. He had the money. So one time we went there and they had just set up spiritual sky incense. And Brahmananda was trying to sell Burjan some incense holder with some what was called gum arabic, which they burn on a piece of charcoal. So I looked at the incense burner and I said, Burjan, don't buy it. It looks pretty fragile. That if you buy it, I think it's going to burn. So Brahmananda, who's a big guy, he was a wrestler, so he picked me up and took me outside. He was also sweet. I remember one time I came for the Ramachandra's appearance day to New York. And I walked into the temple there at 61 Second Avenue at that time. And Brahmananda ran up to me and picked me up and hugged me. And he said, did you do it? I said, what did I do? He said, did you fast? Because it was like, you know, the biggest austerity you could possibly imagine. No fasting. And for those Ramachandra appearance days, we fast until moonrise. So they had one person stationed on the roof of the building waiting for the moon to rise. I mean, Prashadam was quite special back then. And then they served out Prashadam. And it was all green. They dyed everything green, and the dal was green. The chapatis were green, the rice was green, the sabjis were green. Everything was dyed green. And then they served up prasadam, and there was a plate of prasadam. It was like, you know, I thought it was Little Govardhan Hill or something. And that was first. Because Prabhupada's motto was that, you know, when you first join, you eat so much prasadam that you have to waddle like a duck. And actually the devotees were waddling like hippopotamuses. I couldn't believe how much they could actually eat. Because I was eating a little bit also. Confessions of Prashadamata. So Brahmananda took me outside and said, you know, Prabhupada trained us up. You know, so I said, oh, really? And then Virjan, you know, somewhere or another, he bought it. He brought it, we brought it back to Buffalo. We put the incense holder there. We put the charcoal on it. We put the gum arabic on it. We burned the gum arabic, and the charcoal started on fire. And the first time it burnt the incense burner, the whole thing burnt down. Yeah, of course, I'm always right. especially when it's obvious like that. No, I'm always right, of course. So I was sitting there with Prabhupada, and Prabhupada was talking to Garga Muni and Brahmananda. I mean, he's like, I was the treasurer. And he comes to me one day, and he says, we need $100 a day for prasadam. I said, what? I mean, $100 was like, you know, maybe $1,000 now. So, and he said, you know, Prabhupada said, we need $100, you know, for... And, you know, that was like our month's, you know, our income or something. So I was sitting there and I was thinking, you know, well, the first thing Prabhupada does, Devananda was Prabhupada's assistant at that time, and he brings in the plate for Artik, and Prabhupada looks at it and says, it's dirty, go clean it. So then I learned you're supposed to clean the Artik plate. And then we're sitting there, and then Birbhadra, who was 8 years old at the time, is the son of Shalavati. He's telling Prabhupada about their exploits at Spiritual Sky and how sometimes someone would give him $20. He said, I'll give you change. And then he'd go in the back and never appear again. And then, you know, I thought, my God, you know, I was one of these people from New York that if you went to a candy store and they gave you extra change, you give it back to them. Candy stores where they used to sell sweets and things like that. So Prabhupada looked at me, he saw I was shocked, because I never even conceived it, except for my mother. I used to take the extra change, and I used to buy stamps with them. That was the worst thing I ever did. My mother knew it, she used to laugh about it. But Prabhupada looked at me, I was so shocked. And then he looked at me and smiled, and he said, business means cheat. Then I got trained up, as I said before, I got trained up later on in business, book selling business. So during that week, you know, I got a chance to be with Prabhupada. Sometimes, because I was a student, so half a day I went to the university, but I got a chance to sit there. And, you know, Prabhupada, there weren't very many devotees in the temple. We had like five devotees in the whole temple at most. And so Prabhupada would talk to me sometimes, another devotee, for hours at a time. And one time I was getting a little restless. And I thought, because I was practicing to be a mystic yogi before I joined the movement. So part of my business was to read auras. So I was sitting there trying to read Prabhupada's aura. And he looked at me and he said, we are not mystic yogis, we are devotees. That was the last time I tried. And Prabhupada had a guest later on, his name was Dr. Lal. And Dr. Lal, he was an Indian gentleman, he had invited Rupanuga to come to Buffalo and to open the center there, but he was an impersonalist. So Prabhupada was talking to him and he said that the Vedas are like your mother and they tell you who your father is, Krishna. Just like if you want to find out who your father is, you have to ask your mother. But Dr. Lal couldn't understand what Prabhupada was talking about. So then Prabhupada said, just like if you want to find out who your father is, you have to ask your mother. So the Vedas are like our mother and they tell us Krishna is our father. And Dr. Lal still couldn't understand. So I was thinking, wow, you know, Prabhupada, maybe you should try something. I was thinking, maybe you should try another tactic. And finally, Prabhupada said, the Vedas are like our if you want to find out who your father is, you have to ask your mother. So the Vedas are our mother, and they tell us Krishna's our father. And Dr. Lau still couldn't understand. So Prabhupada rang the bell, Purushottam came, and he said, please get prasadam. That was the end of the conversation. So I learned, keep it simple. If you can't understand A, don't try to go to B. It's like Professor Katovsky probably was talking to him for a long time in Moscow. First he started out, how we're not this body. And Professor Katovsky could not understand anything that Prabhupada talked about. And then Prabhupada got into Van Ashram, that we should have first class men in society. And that was the last thing Professor Katovsky wanted to hear, because he didn't believe in first class men. And he couldn't understand that either. So Prabhupada asked Professor Katovsky, could you please get me a taxi? And Professor Katovsky said, sorry, Swamiji, I can't do that either. So Prabhupada had to go out in the street with Sharma Sundar and find a taxi in Moscow. So keep it simple. And then they brought in prasadam. And then Dr. Lal said, Swamiji, I wrote an article for Back to Godhead, and it hasn't been published. I was thinking, well, I could figure out why. And Prabhupada rang the bell, Purushottam comes, this man has written an article for Back to Godhead. Please see that it's published. Because it was never published. Later on that week, there was one devotee who had joined, and we were having a program at Buffalo State University, which is a teacher's college. And this devotee was a little unusual. His name was Kusha Krata. Actually, he got initiated as Kusha Krata later on. Because he used to come to our temple, and he was catatonic. He'd stand at the entrance to our temple for hours and just drool. He wouldn't do anything. He'd just stand there and drool. And we couldn't figure out what to do with him. So the Prabhupada was giving the lecture, and Kusha Krata, before I forget his first name, he was on the ground. Peter. Peter started to crawl on the ground in the middle, after the end when it was time for questions. And he's saying, Swamiji, how far do you have to get down to understand Krishna? So Prabhupada was actually quite tolerant. Yeah, later on he became the translator in Sanskrit of, hundreds of volumes of our Acharya's literature. And Prabhupada walked out, and one transcendental meditator came up to him and said, Swamiji, he said, what's the difference between transcendental meditation and your Krishna consciousness? And Prabhupada's answer was, we just chant Hare Krishna. Prabhupada was actually generally quite simple in his response to things. He didn't try to make it very complicated. So during that time, I asked Prabhupada different questions. One of the questions I asked him, I said, Prabhupada, if Krishna wants me to do something and Krishna doesn't want me to do something, how will I know what Krishna wants me to do? So Prabhupada looked at me and started to laugh. And everyone else started to laugh too. And then Prabhupada shook his head and said, you won't know what to do. He said, you'll do the wrong thing. And then everyone else started to laugh. And then Prabhupada gave me this look of compassion, because he wanted to make sure that I didn't get upset. And then I asked Prabhupada, I said, should I control my desire to eat prasadam? And Prabhupada looked at me and started to laugh. He usually did that. Every time I asked him a question, he'd start laughing. And he said, no, you can eat as much as you want, but don't fill yourself up to here. And every time I asked Prabhupada a question, he was always as sarcastic as I was. Prabhupada, he was more sarcastic than I. One time I was in the garden with Prabhupada and Karanda in L.A. And Prabhupada, I had become the temple president of Dallas, Texas. And I drove there with some devotees for the Rath Yatra in San Francisco. And generally the temple presidents had darshan with Prabhupada in the garden. So I went into the garden. The first thing Prabhupada asked me was, how is your farm doing? Because the previous temple president had written to Prabhupada that we had a farm. And we didn't have a farm. Says, I don't really know Prabhupada. So Prabhupada just passed that away, aside. And then he looked up in the tree, and he said, do you see the bird? I said, bird? Yeah, of course I see the bird. I couldn't even see the tree. I figured the Prabhupada said there was a bird, there was probably a bird there. And I said, see that bird? He said, actually the bird, he's not anxiety. That he knows that tomorrow there's going to be a worm. And he has his home, and he has his house, and therefore he's not in anxiety. He said, why should you be in anxiety? So I said, all right. And then Prabhupada looked at me and said, so are you convinced about Krishna? So I said, yes, Prabhupada. And then Prabhupada started to talk again. And then he looked at me again. He said, so are you convinced about Krishna? I said, yes, Prabhupada. And then Prabhupada started to talk again. A little while later, he looked at me and said, so, are you convinced about Krishna? And then Karanda said, Prabhupada, there's these people, they came to us, and they told us, to the temple, they told us we should go out to the airport, and we should meet the God coming in. He's coming in on an airplane. We should go and meet him and greet him. Guru Maharaji. So Prabhupada said, Guru Maharaji? He said, you should go there and kick him in the face with shoes on. The pie story? What's that?
Another time with Guru Maharaji. Prabhupada was hearing about him. He said, you should kick him in the face. You should pass urine in his face, and you should throw a pie in his face. So one devotee thought, that's a good service. So he was serious about it. Later on, he told Radhanath Maharaj about it, and Ram Maharaj told me, and he said. So I went to one of his meetings, and I had this nice chocolate cream pie, and I sat in the front row. And then at the right time when he was talking, I got up and I threw it right in his face. And then all his men came and they grabbed me and they took me in the back room, and they said, why did you do that? And he said, well, he's God. Why didn't he stop me? And they said, well, that was his leela.
And then at that time, Prabhupada told us, he told Karanda and myself, he said, I want every temple in the Western world to choose two devotees and send them to India to help with our Indian project. And at that time, going to India was not exactly like, walking around the street. I mean, it cost a lot of money to go to India at that time. It was far away. And then Prabhupada started to talk about management in India. He said, he made this face, which was unbelievable, of disgust about the management in India. And it wasn't until I got to India in 1974 or 72 that I realized what Prabhupada was talking about. I arrived at the airport there, and it was the first jumbo jet that ever arrived in the in the Dum Dum Airport in Calcutta. Dum.
Was.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like things were there, and I got out of the airport, and people were just sitting around doing nothing. I said, "What is going on here? What's happening here?" I mean, that experience. The Prabhupada was there actually, and that was the first temple president's reunion, and Prabhupada was giving a lecture every day at that time. We didn't have a temple, really. It was the only thing that was completed, not completed. If you go to Mayapur and you go to the temple they have now, they have a little area where they have a diorama exhibit. It's really small. And that was the temple at that time, where all the devotees, the 100 devotees, fit into. And we had 100 temple presidents there, and no one knew how to cook. We had a lot of chiefs and no Indians. It was my turn to cook. So I was a cook, actually. I had got trained up by Aniruddha, who was personally trained him up how to cook. So I had some experience. That was one, even though I was the temple president, I was also cooking, like Anandapuru. Not quite as good as Ananda, but I had a smaller temple. And so they told me, I said, what should I cook? They said, well, you should cook some peanuts. So I, you know, peanuts, no problem cooking peanuts because it was a codicil. And I said, they said, cook it in a wok. No problem. Where do I get the sand from? Because I knew if you had to cook peanuts in sand, it had to be filtered sand. It had to be pure sand. They said, no problem. We don't have that sand. Filtered sand. All we have is sand in the back of the temple. So you dig up the dirt from the back of the temple and you fry the peanuts in the dirt. I said, that's not going to work. He said, look, that's all we have here. Don't complain. Just do it. So I fried the peanuts to the best I could. And then I couldn't figure out how am I going to, because usually you wash the sand out of the peanuts. Which is pretty easy when you have refined sand, it doesn't stick. But it's dirt. So 3 hours later, I was still washing the sand off the peanuts. So what am I going to do with these peanuts? You know, how can anyone eat? They said, no, just offer them. There's nothing else. So we served these peanuts, all the devotees, and I went around to the devotees asking, how were the peanuts? And they said, they're pretty good. The devotees were hungry like anything. They said they're pretty good, but they're a little gritty. Anyhow, I mean, India at that time was quite amazing. I mean, we had absolutely, you know, the food was so scarce, but they told us, don't go outside and buy anything. So I was so hungry that the last day of the festival, which was like 5 days in Mayapur, and then we took this train to go to Mumbai. Oh, yeah. That train was all right. We arrived in Mumbai. First of all, I had bought sweets on the outside, but I didn't realize the sweets were 90% sugar and 10% parasites. So I never got sick before, but that was the first time I got seriously sick. I mean, I didn't know what hit me. Anyways, we wind up in Mumbai, which was like, there was no place to sleep. We were sleeping on the ground outside. It was a construction site with the rats running around. And They had nice Rasa Bihari were there in a shack. And then we took a train from there to Vrindavan. And at that time they had coal-burning trains. And we all were going in third class. Maybe it was second class. I don't think it was a difference.
<It's>
And we were going there, and coming in through all the windows was the soot.
Yes.
So the train was like 36 hours or something like that. And we were just like covered with soot. And you couldn't sleep because every time they wound up at a train station, all you could hear was, chai, chai. So all night long we were dreaming of chai, chai. And people were coming on doing these stunts, you know, trying to get us to buy things. So finally we came to Vrindavan, we had to burn our dhotis because they were completely black. There was no question of washing them. But the nice thing was that Jamuna Devi Dasi was cooking for us every day, except I couldn't eat anything. Because me and the parasites didn't get along. I did take them to a trip. We did take them back to the United States. To the tropical disease clinic and wish them farewell. In any case, Prabhupada used to lecture every night, so we got a chance. And Prabhupada, at that time in Vrindavan, there was no temple at all. It was just, the only thing that was prepared was, but there's nothing, it was a construction site. And we were living at Fogel Ashram. And if you ever go to Vrindavan now, it's completely different. Prabhupada mentioned in one of his classes, he said, isn't this so nice? We're out here. There are no rickshaws. There are no, you know, there are no cars. There's no this noise and things like that. Because we were living in Fogel Ashram, which is like maybe a kilometer away from the temple. And we'd get up in the morning to go to Mangala Arati, and there was no light because there were no buildings, there was nothing. Because one day, one devotee, we didn't know we were supposed to bring flashlights, but one day one devotee stepped on a dog, and that wasn't so pleasant for the dog and for the devotee. But we were far away, and we were living with the monkeys in Fogel Ashram. So we'd hang up our clothes, and then the monkeys would come and just rip them to pieces. And then we go, anyhow, it was an experience for a Westerner to come to India. And then Prabhupada would give, it was actually a construction site, so Prabhupada, his rooms weren't even ready at that time. Nothing was ready. So, but Prabhupada would give a lecture every morning and the evening. And at that time, 1 rupee was a dollar practically. So for 1 rupee, you could get the maha plate. So later on, the next time I went to India, and with Radha Damodar, and Prabhupada was, at that time, it was a big controversy between the householders and Radha Damodar, because Radha Damodar was stealing the temple presidents and other devotees from each temple. That way they got a good Sankirtan party. So the temple presidents were all householders and they didn't like it. And there was a lot of complaints to Prabhupada. So Prabhupada one time, he told, Tamal Krishna Maharaj was elected the chairman of the GBC at that time, and he was also the head of Radha Damodar. So he thought it was perfectly all right because we were distributing books. So part of the pitch to the devotees in the temple, he said, you're living in these temples, they're useless. All you're doing is going out, you're collecting money so these households can eat and sleep. You should join Radha Damodar and actually do some real book distribution. So when the Radha Damodar used to pull out the devotees at night, the devotees would be waiting there to jump on the bus and take them away. So complaints came to Prabhupada, and then Tamal Krishna Maharaj had this, the GBC passed all these resolutions that year, 1976. Forbidding the ladies from being in the temple, etc., all these. And Prabhupada got the resolutions because Prabhupada used to look them over and sent them back to all get changed. That's where Prabhupada came up with the slogan, resolution, revolution, dissolution, no solution. And then Prabhupada was trying to figure out, he was talking to Tamal Krishnamurti, how are we going to solve this problem? All these devotees, they, you know, they're all up in arms. Because at that time, Radha Damodar was like, you know, the top of the world. We were distributing, collecting hundreds and thousands of dollars every month. And, you know, book distribution was very dear to Prabhupada, so there was this idea that we're infallible. So then Tamal Krishnamurti was talking to Prabhupada, what should we do about this problem? And then Tamal Krishnamurti says, well, maybe you should just send me to China. You know, just whimsically.
If you were did something wrong, you would say that.
Yeah, in America, you see, yeah, I'm going to go to China. You know, it was just like, you know. So the next day, he sends Guru Kripa to get Tamal Krishnamurti. And the first thing Tamal Krishnamurti said, I'm not going. Tamal Krishnamurti was very intelligent. He said, I'm not going. No, he probably wants to see you. No, I'm not going. You just tell him I'm not going. So he calls, Tamal Krishnamurti gets into Prabhupada's quarters. And Prabhupada said, remember what you told me yesterday? About maybe I should just send you to China? Tamal Krishnamurti said, I'm not going. I'm not going. So Prabhupada, his lips started to quiver. He was putting on tilak. And his lips started to quiver. And he said, either you go, or you stay here in Mayapur, and you just spend the rest of your life just chanting japa. But what about Radha Damodar? Who cares about Radha Damodar? So Tamal Krishnamurti had to go. And that, for me, because I was just one of the devotees on Radha Damodar, it meant that all the money that we had taken to India for our pilgrimage went to pay for Tamal Krishnamurti's and Drishtadyu Maharaj's fare. So they collected all the money we had and they gave us 10 rupees for the rest of the festival. It wasn't very much, you know. Then I had to learn how to beg from the householders. In any case, Prabhupada was very expert. The side of Prabhupada I saw, because I saw in the beginning, Prabhupada was always very careful dealing with me. He kind of reflected. Everyone I saw that Prabhupada had dealt with, he actually kind of reflected whatever their mentality was, whatever their consciousness, whatever the situation was. Prabhupada reflected that. And therefore, if we read Prabhupada's instructions, his books, his conversations, sometimes we may think that Prabhupada was contradicting himself or he said things that, you know, were inappropriate according to our present political correctness. But Prabhupada, generally speaking, if one was in different situations, Prabhupada did not try to contradict people, especially if he thought they wouldn't hear his message. Or he modified things sometimes, you know, we didn't go to the moon. Sometimes he said we went to the moon, but they couldn't see the people there. Sometimes he said they went to the Arizona desert. Sometimes he said they went to Rahu. He didn't care so much about exactly, you know, the specifics. What he cared most about is making the atmosphere conducive so that people would accept Krishna consciousness, that they'd actually understand the fundamental principle that Krishna is God. And if he was going to disturb their mind, then sometimes he left things. Apparently, he changed things. In any case, there is a wealth of information. I don't have to tell so many stories because there's so many devotees who have told so many stories about Prabhupada. But ultimately, to understand Prabhupada, we have to read Bhagavad Gita. Because otherwise, and we have to get some mercy from Krishna, the Super Soul. Because otherwise it's very hard. It's said that it's practically impossible to understand a pure devotee. That the only thing I could understand is that Prabhupada saw, as Chandra Mali Maharaj said he actually saw us as spiritual souls. In 1969, we went to Boston to see Srila Prabhupada. From Buffalo, we went to New York and we did Harinam there. I went to see my parents, who didn't know I was a devotee. I walked in, my parents couldn't believe it. Yeah, I walked in like that. They never saw anything like that. So my mother looked at me and said, "You can't." I was going to my sister's wedding. So my mother said, "You can't be in here like that." So I said, "No problem." I just walked out. And my parents were like shocked. They met me at the bottom of the elevator. And they said, "All right, at least for your sister's wedding, you can be here like that." So I said, "All right." So I went there and I preached to my relatives the best I could. And I never saw my parents again for 7 years. Till they called me up and asked for forgiveness. Yeah, that was... In any case, later on I start to see them regularly. They got some association with Rose Farkish. So they even attended some programs and things. They gave a lot of donations. So we went there to Boston, and this is the first time we ever had a temple. The devotees had actually bought a temple. And it was a two-floor temple, and they had installed the BBT there, the printing press. So Prabhupada, especially, this is Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Prabhupada's appearance day in 1969. And so Prabhupada was supposed to come to the airport, and we were having kirtan in the second floor. And then suddenly I looked up, and I saw Lord Chaitanya. I still remember the picture. Lord Chaitanya has his arms like that, out like this. The kirtan party's in the back. And he started to glow. I said, "What's going on?" And he appeared so enthusiastic. The whole kirtan party. And then suddenly Prabhupada started to glide up the stairs. And the whole room turned into Vaikuntha. Everyone in that room felt they were in Vaikuntha. And I was trying to remember what I was worried about, because I was always worried about something, but I couldn't remember it. Because I was actually in a different world. And then Prabhupada looked at me. He sat on the Vyasasan and looked at me. And I could actually see, he could actually see who I was. And then he started to give a lecture about Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Prabhupada, which is not recorded for some. Actually, first thing, there was one lady, I forget her name, she came up the stairs, and Prabhupada looked at her and said, "Don't fight with your husband." Vaikunthanath was her husband. And then Prabhupada started to tell stories about Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Prabhupada. Saradi. And then Prabhupada started to tell stories one after another about Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Prabhupada. And that was the first time I ever heard Prabhupada just continuously tell stories. And for the whole time, for some reason, I couldn't stop crying. I was just crying the whole time. And then Prabhupada got up, went down to see the printing press, and I was back in Boston again. Then I remember what I was worried about. So Prabhupada's presence, the first time I saw Prabhupada's presence was when Prabhupada walked in for a lecture at the University of Buffalo. And when he walked in, I actually entered into Brahman. Not Krishna consciousness, I was Brahman. I actually understood what Brahman realization, everything became the light. And then Prabhupada began, there were like hundreds of students because we had invited them from the university for the lecture. And Prabhupada started to talk about God. And from my experience at the university, God was worse than a four-letter word. Four-letter words were normal. God, G-O-D. I remember one time, one of my professors was talking to Jagadish Prabhu about God. He was telling the professor about God. And I was getting so embarrassed he was using the word. No one talked about God in school. So Prabhupada started to give a lecture about God. And I said, no, no, I was thinking, don't say that. And the students started to get up and walk out. And Prabhupada was completely unfazed by the whole thing. You know, he just kept on with the lecture. And then that was the first time I heard Prabhupada play the drum, which was like so amazing, hearing Prabhupada play the drum. And he gave the lecture, students walked out, and Prabhupada, every time Prabhupada came and gave a lecture, he gave the lecture, he didn't really, I mean, he was very sensitive. At that time, I remember Prabhupada was giving a lecture at one university, and he started to talk about how Brahmananda had told him that the boys and girls in America, sometimes they, you know, they get undressed and they go into the pigsty. And I was watching Prabhupada, and Prabhupada was watching us, and when he saw that some of the devotees started to get agitated, immediately he changed the subject into something else. That Prabhupada was so aware of what was going on in his preaching. In any case, there's so much to say about Prabhupada, but the main thing is that Prabhupada had a very deep desire to help each soul that he met become Krishna conscious. And he was so much empowered by Lord Krishna that he knew exactly what to say and how to say it in order to inspire someone as best he could to try to take up the process of Krishna consciousness. It didn't always work, but Prabhupada certainly tried. And therefore he was able to produce different moods, different instructions, different... Prabhupada was able to do different things in order to try to do that. And for that reason, the movement grew. Not due to Prabhupada's, you know, planning of every detail of management and things like that. As a matter of fact, when he came to America, generally I was a temple president, and Prabhupada, in every temple I was at, Prabhupada never gave very many instructions. Except one time, Prabhupada, I was with Sesrup Maharaj, I was a temple president, he was a temple president, and we were in Dallas, and Prabhupada, we got to be with Prabhupada to have darshans with him regularly. And Sesrup Maharaj was the temple president of Dallas, so he was telling Prabhupada of all the problems that we were having with the devotees there. And after a few minutes of hearing that, Prabhupada just stopped him and said, "Devotee? If they're a devotee, they're first class." And that ended all the questions of problems. But we can learn from Prabhupada about how to deal with others. And if we're sincere, then Krishna will give us the intelligence how to help them become Krishna conscious. And if we do that, then Krishna will be pleased. Our acharyas will be pleased, and we'll go back to the spiritual world. Hare Krishna. Thank you.